The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, August 31st, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, folks, it's Casual Friday. So casual, I'm not even here. I'm on vacation. Yes, it's the final pre-recorded show of our vacation. And today we got a doozy for you. We were going to put in a pre-recorded interview that I had done, but we're going to play that later with sometime next week, the week coming up, because we realize we have so many new listeners of the program who are not familiar with so many of the inside jokes that we talk about. And one of the greatest sources of our inside joking on this program comes from a series of debates, one of the debates, both of the debates, that I did with a libertarian, a professor who was a Ron Paul advisor, also advisor Rand Paul, who I think has since become a Trumpista, which is not terribly surprising. But I remember preparing for this debate, and I was like, I said to Michael, like, I've got to read in. I haven't debated a professor who's a libertarian before. I've debated libertarians, but this is a professor. This guy has got a full tenure at Loyola University at their libertarian division or wherever it was. And Walter Block came on, and it was one of the craziest debates I've ever had. And there was a second one. The one we're going to play today is from May 26, 2014. There was a second one in February. If you go to YouTube, you can search at youtube.com/Sam Cedar, our libertarian playlist, and see all these interviews, debates, and whatnot. But this one was pretty crazy. It's a Friday. It's Casual Friday. It's the last day of August. We just said, to heck with it all, we're going to play this. People will enjoy it. I don't need another deep interview. This is beach reading, folks. Beach viewing. So sit back, enjoy this. Remember, you can support this program day in, day out by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Less than 50 cents a day, you can become a member. Matt will be providing our members a deep archive cut in the fun half. On Monday, we will have our famous Labor Day compilation, which we run every Labor Day, more or less. Matt needs to recover from his cold that he developed in the future during vacation. So he's going to work on that. And we'll all be back live on, let's see, it's we'll be back live on Monday, Tuesday the 4th. So, but sit back, enjoy this. Walter Block, if you're in a place where you don't want to laugh, you can't laugh, I think you should maybe just put this on hold. This is going to be pretty funny.
Do one of the previous interviews. Yep.
All right, here it is. We're going to take a quick break. Come back. I'll be debating Walter Block. And, well, enjoy. Phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Walter E. Block. He is the Harold E. Worth Eminent Scholar, Endowed Chair, and Professor of Economics at the Joseph A. Butt College of Business at Loyola University in New Orleans. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Sam, thanks.
In exchanging emails, you've asked me to do my best not to interrupt and that we won't interrupt each other, and within the confines of the medium, I will endeavor to do so. And we agreed to start with the premise of
why don't we start with the
laissez-faire capitalism is the best system for mankind, both from an ethical and an economic point of view. So tell us why that is the case.
Well, just briefly, what laissez-faire capitalism is a voluntary trade between consenting adults. And every time a voluntary trade occurs, for example, if I trade my pen for your wristwatch, it must be that there's something about your wristwatch I like better than my pen, and there's something about my pen that you like better than your wristwatch, and therefore there's mutual gain, at least in the ex ante sense of anticipations. Ex post, one of us may regret the trade later, but at least in the initial outset, we are trading because we each expect to benefit. And this applies to barter and to buying and selling and renting and employment and every other contract investing in the market system. So it's mutually beneficial, and this is sort of a deontological proof of it, namely the logic. There's a lot of empirical evidence that attests to the fact that the countries that are closest to laissez-faire capitalism, namely have the most economic freedom, are also the richest. For example, Hong Kong and Singapore, in the empirical analyses, are the most free countries in the world, and they're among the richest. And from an ethical point of view, it's also beneficial because it's based on voluntarism, no coercion. If anyone pulls a gun on anyone else and forces him or compels him or prohibits him from doing anything in a commercial interaction, well, then that would be outside of laissez-faire capitalism. So what's inside laissez-faire capitalism is just voluntary interaction, and voluntary interaction is ethical.
Now, is it your sense that we don't have that type of a freedom to engage in exchange in this country?
Well, we've got some. When I first did my empirical research, in I think the first book was 1976, the U.S. was the fourth freest country. Well, now I think something like the 15th or 16th freest country, which is pretty good out of, I don't know, 150 or 200 countries, but, you know, not as good as it could be. So we've got a modicum of economic freedom, although it is curtailed in many different ways.
Let's talk about how it's curtailed in your perspective.
Well, for example, take the minimum wage law. That curtails it in the sense that I now offer you a job washing my car or whatever at $6 an hour, and let's say you agree, and we can both go to jail for that. They probably wouldn't put you in jail because they would think I was exploiting you, but theoretically we could both go to jail because the minimum wage law is $7.25 an hour. And if we, two consenting adults, come to an agreement for $6 an hour, it's illegal. So our freedom to have an employment contract is, in that instance, curtailed.
And so how is that, how is the idea that I would get, I mean, when we talk about the minimum wage, the idea that I would get a living wage or a wage that could sustain me, how is that unethical? A, and how does it hurt us economically?
Well, I mean, let's say $20 an hour is a sustainable, or what did you call it, I forget?
A living wage.
Living wage, sorry. Let's say $20 an hour is a living wage, and I'm offering you six. Have I hurt you? Have I, in any sense, engaged in uninvited border crossing? Have I used coercion against you? No. I've not worsened your position. I don't know what your situation is right now, in hypothetical. I'm not talking about you as an actual person, rather you as a theoretical person. I come up to you and say, hey, come work for me for $6. What do you say? And, you know, if you can make $20 an hour at a living wage, will you say, well, thanks for your offer, but no thanks, if you're a polite person. If you're not polite, you'll say something else. On the other hand, if right now your wage is, say, $2 an hour, you'll say, whoop-de-doo, $6, that's great. So I think that either I can't hurt you, or possibly I can help you. Now, it would be nice if you were making $20 an hour, and if you were, then my offer of $6 will just sort of flow off your back like water off a duck's back. You're not going to seriously entertain it. But I haven't hurt you. I haven't violated your rights. And I might have improved your situation if your situation was much more dire, namely, say, you were making $2 an hour, or you were unemployed and had no other job opening. $6 an hour is better than nothing.
Well, now let's talk about the living people. I mean, when we talk about actual individuals, we know that in many instances, if you're making even, let's say, the minimum wage as it is now, never mind getting rid of it, many of those people cannot afford to feed their families without government assistance. They can't afford to get health care without government assistance. You know, we're all well aware of, you know, the stories of how many Walmart workers are required to get nutritional assistance and medical assistance. We also know that in the case of, you know, I mean, so I'm not sure how it's unethical that someone would receive a higher minimum wage. But also from an economic standpoint, we know that just there was a report today that I saw that raising the minimum wage will actually put an additional $35 billion. I mean, specifically when we're talking about the $10.10 an hour, it'll increase the wages of almost 29 million workers by $35 billion, and it will increase economic activity. How is that bad for the economy, and how is that unethical?
Well, I think it's bad for the economy because right now, let's say there's somebody who's making $9 an hour. Right now, the minimum wage law is $7.25, and we're now contemplating, say, raising it to $10.10.
Right.
Right. And right now, there's some guy who's making $9 an hour, let's say. And the reason he's being paid $9 an hour is because his employer thinks he's worth $9 an hour. And probably that's what his productivity is, because if his productivity were less than $9 an hour, let's say $8 an hour, the employer would lose a dollar an hour off of him, so he wouldn't hire him if he was only worth $8. And if he were really worth, say, $9.50, his wage would tend to rise to $9.50 because some other employer would offer $9.01 and someone else would offer $9.02. So in economics, we have this, I don't know, axiom or aphorism or something that says that wages tend to equal marginal revenue product or productivity. So here's a guy who's now making $9 an hour, and let's say his productivity is $9 an hour, and now we raise the wage minimum wage to $10.10. And now the employer says to himself, hey, this guy, Joe, who I used to hire at 9, now I have to pay him $10.10. I'm going to lose $1.10 off of him. I'm going to fire him. So that wouldn't be good for that guy because he loses his job, and now he has to twiddle his thumbs.
Right. Well, Professor, but that doesn't necessarily follow because we haven't, when we have raised the minimum wage, I mean, we have real-world examples of this dynamic where we have raised the minimum wage in states. There are plenty of states in the country where it's actually higher than 7.25. And when it goes up, there's no measurable job loss. We also know that relative to productivity, the minimum wage in this country has not kept up with rises in productivity. Yet we have had stagnant wages. So how is that explained by your theory?
Well, it's hardly my theory.
Well, you're espousing.
Right. I wish I could claim originality. This is like a mainstream economic theory.
Not so mainstream, but okay. But nevertheless, the theory you're espousing.
Well, yes. The theory I'm espousing says that when you raise wage, you see, the minimum wage law doesn't compel anyone to hire anyone. The minimum wage law doesn't.
No, I understand that, but I'm sorry.
We did say we weren't going to interrupt.
Right, yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. Well, go ahead. It's your turn. I don't want
to. Well, I'm saying, I'm asking you to, how does, I mean, I get what your theory says, but I'm saying, how does your theory reconcile itself with the real world empirical data that I've just presented to you?
Well, the real-world empirical data is highly problematic because it depends upon the timing. Let me give you an example from a couple of decades ago. At one time, the minimum wage was 40 cents an hour. I think this was in the 1940s or somewhere. And they raised it to 70 cents an hour, which was the highest percentage increase ever, even higher than from 7.25 to 10.10.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, if you walked into an elevator, there'd be a guy standing there. He wasn't a pervert. He was the elevator operator. And you'd say, 12th floor, please, and he would, you know, get you up to the 12th floor. Well, they raised the minimum wage from 40 to 70 cents, and the very next day, did any automatic elevator guy get fired? No, because it takes a little time to introduce automation, which was not competitive at 40 cents an hour, but was very competitive with labor at 70 cents an hour. So if you took your empirical studies of the minimum wage a day or a week or a month or maybe even 6 months after the minimum wage, what you would have found is that the wages rose to from 40 to 70 cents, and virtually none of those people were fired. But after 6 months or 8 months, then they started to get fired, and pretty much after a year or two, however long it took to rearrange matters to introduce the automation, they all lost their jobs. So the empirical stuff, you have to be very careful with that. I would say that of all empirical work on this question, maybe 90-95% of all the empirical work shows that if you wait a long enough time for adjustments to occur, there is very serious deleterious employment effect.
Well, now.
The problem is, though, that if you wait too long, then other things happen. So the empirical stuff is very iffy. Anyone can prove anything he wants by just the timing of when he takes the
Even in your example, you're talking about, when we're talking about laborers in the context of Walmart, let's say, or in McDonald's, there may not be an automation solution. But even within the context of your example, you're not saying that there's a problem with the minimum wage. You're saying that there may be a certain point where an increase in the minimum wage, in your case, it was the example that you gave, was almost was nearly, I guess, 75%. Maybe there is a point between 40 and 70 cents an hour where it doesn't become effective. I mean, in other words, your example there does not in any way disprove, it does not necessarily mean that it's going to create job loss. It just means that at 70 cents an hour for elevator operators, it could have impact down the road. But, I mean, if we're not going to, I mean, here's what's problematic, is that your theory is nice, but my theory is that if you give more money into the hands of those people who are living at the lowest rung of the economic ladder, they're going to spend it. It's going to necessarily create more economic activity, and it's going to necessarily create more jobs, because demand, as much as, Bob or whoever it was in that first example, the bottom line is I hire people when I have more business. And if I got more business coming through, I'm willing to take that that dollar hit on that guy I'm paying $9. If I've got 25% more demand coming in, I can not only pay for that, but I'm actually going to have increased profits.
Hello? You faded out.
I'm sorry.
Sam?
Yeah? Are you there?
It's like dead air now. You're not speaking, and I don't know what's happening.
Oh, I'm. Let me. Can you hear me, Professor?
Now I can hear you, but there was like a 10-second dead silence right
I'm
in
sorry,
the middle, like you were cut off or something.
Well, what I was saying was that that in my example, in my theory, the more money you put in the hands of people who will spend it immediately, which are people who are making the minimum wage or less than the minimum wage, it's going to increase economic activity. It's going to increase demand. And that's going to be the driving force behind whether or not I hire more people.
Right. Well, I tend to disagree with that. I think that what you're conflating or confusing or bringing together, which shouldn't be brought together, is when the minimum wage law rises, that people will actually be paid more. And it's not just a matter of technology, although technology is a way of substituting away. I remember when I was a kid, I would drive into a filling station, and I'd be attacked by about five people. One of them would put the gas in for me, one would check the oil, one would do the windshields, one would check the battery or whatever. And what happened is, because of the minimum wage, we had a lot of self-serves. So it need not be technology, but those jobs are gone. And now what you have is a very, you see, what your theory says is that if the minimum wage rises to a moderate level, maybe not 40 to 70 cents, but maybe 40 to 50 cents or something like that, and maybe not $7.25 to $20 an hour, but $7.25 to $10 an hour, what you're saying is, well, then the people will get more money. But I'm saying the minimum wage law doesn't require that anyone get a job at a higher wage. It just says that if they get a job, then they have to be paid that, but they don't have to get that job.
No, I understand.
Now,
I understand.
Now take this guy who's now his productivity is $9 an hour. His productivity isn't going to change if the minimum wage law goes to 10-10 and nothing else happens. He's going to be fired. How soon he'll be fired is an empirical issue. He might not be fired the next day, but he's going to be fired because his productivity didn't rise. And to pay him 10-10 when he's only worth 9, you lose $1.10.
Well, and if you keep
didn't we say we weren't getting into that?
I know, but you've made the point.
Am I going on too long?
I think we all understand the example of the elevator operator, but my point is that we're simply arguing theories here. You won't accept the empiricism because you says we really can't measure this in the real world is what you're suggesting.
No. I do accept empiricism. These are good illustrations. And my understanding of the economic literature on this is that about 95% of all empirical work show that there are very serious deleterious effects on unemployment. But much more important are the empirical than the empirical studies are the logic of it. And you're not just, I don't think I'm getting across the logic of it.
No, I understand the logic of it, but I'm suggesting to you.
I don't think you understand the logic of it. You see, the logic of it that you're operating on is that the minimum wage looks like a floor. And as you raise it, the wages rise. Whereas the true account of the minimum wage is not at all a floor. Rather, it's a hurdle over which you have to jump in order to get a job in the first place. And if there's a minimum wage of $7.25, well, then you have to have productivity of higher than $7.25 to get a job. Look,
your argument is that it taken to its logical conclusion that if you were that hurdle was raised too high, you would have less jobs. And I'm saying it's possible that in one sector you may have less jobs, but in another sector you may have more. In fact, even in your example of the elevator operator, I mean, what is the value of an elevator operator to the people who come into the building? If it raises the rents of those people in that building, then the owner of that building will pay for that elevator operator.
Well, he wouldn't have paid for the elevator operator at the old minimum wage of 40, but he will pay for the he wouldn't pay for the automatic elevator when the minimum wage was 40, because then the unskilled labor and the unsophisticated equipment was very competitive with the more sophisticated automatic elevator. But when you price people out of the market, which is what you're doing with the unskilled labor, you price them out of the market, and at 70 cents, they all lost their jobs.
Yes, I know. I mean, again, that's not an argument against the minimum wage. It's against the raising the minimum wage by 75% for elevator operators. But,
well, look, suppose they raise it just from 40 to 45 or something like that, or suppose we raise the minimum wage from 7.25 to 8, which is a moderate increase.
Mm-hmm.
What about all the people who have a productivity in between 7.25 and 8? Suppose I have a productivity of 7.50, and I'm happily employed right now, and now all of a sudden they raise it to 8, and I lose my job. And what about the people right now at 7.25?
But there's nothing in the real world without... I'm sorry,
Sam,
I don't mean to interrupt.
Sam, you are interrupting. Let me just finish the sentence.
Go ahead.
What about the people whose productivity right now is $6 an hour, and we have a minimum wage law of 7? Do you know what the unemployment rate of black teenagers is in the inner cities?
Yeah, well, in the inner cities, it's in the 20s, in the 30s.
In the 40s. which is in the stratosphere. This is horrible. This is a very, very bad situation, and the unemployment rate, the real unemployment rate, is even higher than that, because the unemployment statistics only count you if you're actively seeking a job. But if you've been actively seeking a job and your productivity is $5 or $6 an hour and you haven't been able to find one for a year or two, through the magic of accounting, they don't count you as unemployed. So the real unemployment is just horrendous. And, you know, these young black kids, when they're in effect told by perhaps well-meaning people such as yourself, although not everybody who favors the minimum wage law is well-meaning, when they're told, in effect, that they can't get a job and they have to twiddle their thumbs and they get bored and they get into trouble and they go to jail, this is just a horrible situation. And well-meaning people such as yourself, I think you're well-meaning, I have no reason to think you're not, are just fooled by this. The logic is...
What is the value of making $5 an hour if you're living in New York City?
It's better than zero.
Well, but what is the value of it? If you can't feed your family...
Let me ask you...
If you can't... wait a second. Don't interrupt me here.
I'm sorry. I've interrupted you. I apologize.
I understand. It's all right. I'm used to it. The point is, if we cannot provide a living wage for people, if the market cannot provide a living wage for people, then what is the value of it? I mean, if they cannot go out and rent an apartment, if you cannot go out and feed your children, if you cannot get health care, what is the value of that $3 an hour job? $2 an hour job? Because I imagine you don't agree with the idea that the state should be providing any assistance. What is the value of that? I mean, where does that leave society if we have masses amount of people? You mentioned New York. I mean, we know that in the 1920s, we had literally 20,000 people living on the Bowery, literally on the Bowery. I mean, what is the value of that then? How is that a more ethical society that we live in?
Sam, let me ask you a question, and just answer my question, because I didn't want to take it elsewhere. Which number is higher, 4 or 2?
I'm sorry?
Which number is higher, 4 or 2?
4.
Which number is higher, 6 or 0?
Well, 6.
Ah, okay, great. My point is that if a person has a productivity level of $6 an hour, and there were no minimum wage, he could be paid $6 an hour. When the minimum wage is $7.25, he's paid zero. Now, it's true that $6 an hour is nothing to write home about, but you just...
It's not just to not write home about.
Professor,
you're not answering my question.
Sam, you're interrupting me.
I understand, but you're not answering my question.
I'm not going to answer your question. I'm going to keep going.
All right, go ahead.
When I stop, you can ask the question again.
And you won't answer it again.
Well, I might.
Okay.
But I won't if you keep interrupting me. And didn't you promise not to interrupt?
Well, I said I'd do my best.
Okay, well, try to do a little harder, best. Try to do your best harder, or whatever the word is.
Okay.
Look, not only is $6 better than zero, which you've admitted, but when you're making $6 an hour, you're getting OJT, which is in economic jargon called on-the-job training. When you're working at $6 an hour, you're learning skills. And when you learn skills, then you get a higher productivity and you get a higher wage. When you said, what use is the market when it can't give a living wage, the market doesn't give wages. What gives wages is productivity. And if you stop people from working who are perfectly capable of working at $6 an hour, and you won't let them because you insist on a minimum wage law of $7.25, which prices them out of the market, then you deprive them of on-the-job training, you deprive them of increase in productivity. You keep talking, well, you can't live too well on six. Well, you can't live too well on zero. Six is better than zero no matter how you slice it. And let's forget about welfare. We can talk about welfare another day. Let's suppose that welfare is whatever it is. $6 an hour is still better than $6 an hour plus welfare is better than zero plus welfare, plus you're learning on the job, which is very important.
Now, for this elevator operator, where does his job training lead him? I mean, because when he goes home with his $6 an hour as opposed to $0 an hour, and he cannot live in New York City, He cannot live an hour and a half outside of New York City. He can't afford the transportation in. He can't pay for his kids' food. He can't pay for their health care. How is that helpful and ethical for society? Please answer the question.
Well, it's a lot more ethical than zero.
Why? If he can't live in an apartment and he can't feed his kids, what difference does it make that he can give them two meals a week as opposed to seven meals, as opposed to no meals a week?
So you're taking back your concession to me that six is greater than zero?
No. Six as a number is greater than zero, but not in the context of what it costs to live. I mean, yes, having cancer in one part of your body is better than having your entire body racked with cancer. But at the end of the day, it's still problematic. And so there is a threshold in this country where it takes for you to pay for rent. We know this is all empirical stuff. We know exactly how much money it takes if you want to live in New York for the vast majority of people. We know exactly how much it takes to put food on the table. Yes, six is more than zero. Is it necessarily better, actually? I mean, when we're talking about dollars and we're talking about cost, not necessarily, no. All right, but let's move on. We're not going to get anywhere with this. Let's move on.
No. I don't want to move on. I want to continue right here.
Okay.
You've admitted that the number six is greater than the number zero.
The number six is greater, yes.
Hey, you're interrupting again. I let you go on for about 2 or 3 minutes.
All right, Professor, I'll let you have your final say on this, and then we're going to move on.
Okay. You've admitted that the number six is greater than the number zero.
Yes.
But you don't seem to be open to admitting that $6 is better than $0,
which I find
highly problematic. Now, look, there's this kid. This is black kid in Harlem. And he's got welfare, he's got whatever it is, we're holding that constant, ceteris paribus. You know, the horses have blinders on them when they go in the street. Well, we're going to try to put the blinders on and hold everything else constant. And right now this kid is living. He's living in Harlem. He's in New York City. How? I don't know. He's in the projects, whatever it is. But you know how much he's making from honest work? $0. And I say if we get rid of the minimum wage law, he will get $6, which is better than $0. And you keep going on about, well, it's very expensive in New York City, yak, yak, yak. That's true. But no matter how expensive it is, he's living there now, and his situation would be better with $6 an hour extra than the zero you are consigning him to.
And $9 an hour would be better than six.
The reason he's not making six is because the minimum wage law is $7.25.
No,
and if
but
it was
that's
nine,
just, that's
and
just
if it was,
your...
And if it was nine, 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 I'm going to keep saying if it was nine until you let me finish. You know, I'm not really enjoying it because you did promise not to interrupt, and I've tried not to interrupt you, and I only interrupted you once, and I apologize, and you must have interrupted me 15 times, so please let me finish a sentence.
Okay.
If the minimum wage was $9 an hour, then not only would this kid who is now making, who is now productivity at 6 and unable to get a job, but even people whose productivity is 8 and are making 8, they too would lose out the job, and they would make $0 instead of $8, and $8 is better than $0.
Okay. Well, the evidence of that assertion doesn't exist in the real world, but I know that you don't believe that that we can actually empirically measure that, or at least you've said that it's very suspect when we do. But so let's move on to, and this is not unrelated in many respects, but it was recently in the news, but I want to move on to something that you've written on, I think it was lewrockwell.com. And it was in the context of something else, but I think it's a really interesting point. You wrote that free association is a very important aspect of liberty. It's crucial. Indeed, its lack was a major problem with slavery. That the slaves could not quit. They were forced to associate with their masters when they would have had vastly preferred not to do so. Otherwise, slavery wasn't so bad. You could pick cotton, sing songs, be fed nice gruel, etc. The only real problem was that this relationship was compulsory. It violated the law of free association and that of the slaves. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, then, to a much smaller degree, of course, made partial slaves out of the establishments of the owners of establishments like Woolworth's. Now, so you perceive in this instance that, you know, and I understand that you follow the guiding light, and tell me if I'm wrong on this. I give you permission to interrupt me if it's wrong, of the non-aggression principle. That is that everything is okay but for that which involves the threat of physical violence upon someone. And thus, the Civil Rights Act, which says you as a store owner must serve all comers you cannot deny people based upon race, is encroaching upon their freedom in such a way that they've been made into partial slaves, because the defining aspect of slavery in this instance is the force to associate with people. Is that a fair assessment of what you've written?
Not only fair, but highly accurate. But before I answer that, and you've gone on about 5 minutes here, so give me.
Well, it's my show, to be
minutes.
Fair.
Yeah, well, we're supposed to share. Let me just say that your summary of my views on empirical evidence is wrong. In my understanding, about 95% of all empirical evidence on the minimum wage shows that it creates unemployment for unskilled workers. Okay, now let's get back to this new thing. The new topic about slavery and the Civil Rights Act and free association. Let me read you something from Frederick Douglass, who, this is in 1882, he's a former slave. He's roughly the 19th century equivalent of, I don't know, Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, namely a leader of the black community, a scholar, a person with great effect on the black community. Here's a quote from Frederick Douglass. "My feelings were not the result of any marked cruelty in the treatment I received. They sprang from the consideration of my being a slave at all. It was slavery, not its mere incidents, that I hated. I had been cheated. I saw through the attempt to keep me in ignorance. I saw that slaveholders would gladly made me believe that they were merely acting under the authority of God in making a slave of me and making slaves of others, and I felt to them as robbers and deceivers. The feeding and clothing me well could not atone for taking my liberty from me." End quote. That's Frederick Douglass. What he's saying is that the essence of the evil, he's asking, why is slavery evil? And he was answering it roughly the way I answered it. Namely, it had nothing to do with picking cotton. It had nothing to do with eating gruel. It had nothing to do with, I don't know, living in a cabin, or nothing to do with singing songs or any of it. The key element of slavery was that it violated the law of free association or the axiom of non-aggression. That was what was wrong with slavery. That was what I was telling the New York Times. And those people somehow got from that I thought that slavery was not so bad, which is a perversion of.
I'm not going to defend the way that the New York Times expressed your views. It's not relevant.
Sam, did I go on too long that time? Is that why you're interrupting me?
Oh, I apologize. Continue.
Right. Okay. So. The key element of the evil of slavery was none of these mere incidents, as Frederick Douglass talked about. Rather, it was coercion. It was forcing people against their will to associate with you when they didn't want to. Now, let's take Woolworths and a black person, Woolworths in 1940, whatever, Woolworths in the South. 50. A black person comes in and says, "Hey, what's for lunch?" Or, "I'd like a hamburger." And the guy says, "Sorry, we don't serve black people." And what I'm saying is that if you compel Woolworths to associate with the black person in this way, what you're doing is you're violating the rights of Woolworths. Now, this really sounds horrible to our modern ear. You know, isn't that evil? And again, I approach this from an economic point of view and from an ethical point of view. From an ethical point of view, it's very clear. People should be free to associate with whoever they want. The analogy I use is that if you deny this, what you're really doing is promoting compulsory bisexuality. Now, sit down. Don't interrupt. Let me make this point. The problem with male heterosexuals is that they discriminate against half the human race in terms of love partners or bed partners or whatever. Problem with female heterosexuals is that they do discriminate. They don't go to bed with other females. That's politically correct to attack heterosexuals. I'm now going to do something politically incorrect, and I'm going to attack homosexuals. Male homosexuals are evil discriminators because they, too, discriminate against half the human race, namely women. And lesbians also are evil discriminators because they discriminate against half the human race, namely men. It's only bisexuals who don't discriminate against anyone. So if you're going to logically say that nobody should ever discriminate against anyone, what you're really calling for is compulsory bisexuality. But even bisexuals, bless their hearts, as we say in the South, are evil discriminators because they too discriminate, not on the basis of gender, but on the basis of, I don't know, lookism or a sense of humor or, I don't know, intelligence or whatever normal people discriminate in favor of. So Woolworths should be able to discriminate too. Everyone should be able to discriminate. Everyone does discriminate. I mean, as I say, heteros and homos all discriminate, so nothing wrong with discriminating. Now, you might think...
Professor, wait a second. Now you have actually gone on.
Your turn.
But let me address this.
Your turn.
Don't you see there is a difference between an individual's sexual preference and a business that is engaging in economic activity and is using all of the resources that society has provided as well as a license to do business? That Woolworths was a corporation by not in nature. Woolworths was a corporation because they registered with the state. And so when you say to a black person, you can't go in and eat at Woolworths, or let's use another example. When you say to a black person, you can't come in and buy my goods that you're looking to resell, you're actually preventing them from participating in the economy. And you are fundamentally hurting their ability to live, and even in your laissez-faire capital world, to participate there. Now, so why is that not problematic to you? I mean, I understand this notion that it's a slightly different than just associating with one. It is actually about allowing someone to participate or not participate in the economy based on their skin.
First of all, I didn't say it wasn't problematic. I do regard this as highly problematic. I wouldn't do that. I think it's pretty despicable.
No. I know you wouldn't do it.
Hey, shut up. It's my turn now, isn't it?
Well, you just mischaracterized what I said.
Is it my turn or not?
Well, you mischaracterized me, so I just wanted to do...
Then when it's your turn, you can correct me. But it's my turn now. You said that I thought it was not problematic.
No.
That's what you said.
I think it
is problematic.
Why?
And I don't favor this. I'm making a distinction between should these people be put in jail or not. Now, like, take this guy. What's his name? The Clippers guy.
Sterling.
Sterling, right. The question is, should he be put in jail? And I don't think he should be put in jail. Now, I think what he did... Hey, Sam, can't you control yourself a little bit?
Well, no, because no one's saying he should be put in jail.
Yes, the Woolworths would be put in jail if they violated the law.
This is different. This is a completely different situation. This is a totally different situation. I'm sorry.
Sam, I'm not
Stick
really
to the
this.
Point. You keep avoiding
Sam, I'm
what
really
I'm discussing.
Enjoying this conversation.
I'm finding it tiresome,
this.
Too, because you will not address what I have said. It's okay, we can take turns here, but if you don't address what I say, then this is going nowhere, and I have to do a show here, too, because we're just sitting at a bar. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I've asked you to address, how is it that you think that you're comparing heterosexuality and bisexuality and homosexuality, lifestyle choices, or I should say sexual preference, with a business refusing service to people based on their race? Now, please address that. How is that the same? Do you not recognize that someone engaging in commerce has a different liability? I mean, this is English common law, isn't it? That you have to serve all comers. This has been around for centuries.
I'll try to address it, but as soon as I start in, you interrupt, so it's really hard to get a word in edgewise with you. You know, do you play chess by any chance?
Occasionally.
Do you play with a clock?
No.
Ah. The way you play with a clock is when it's my turn to think, I hit your clock, or rather when it's your turn, I hit my button, and your clock goes.
When we play chess, I promise to play that way, but let's go back to the
no,
point.
No, but the point I'm making now is if we were to, what do you call it, count how many seconds or how many minutes you've had and how many minutes I had, I don't know, I think you'd have more, but I'm not sure.
When I come on your show, you can reverse it.
Okay, fair enough. I'll let you keep interrupting me. I won't object. I'll let you keep talking, and I'll just take 10% of the time. I'll take whatever you can give me, Sam. Okay, let me now address the question that you make, namely, shouldn't we make a distinction between commerce and personal interactions? Is that fair to characterize
yes,
your
specifically
question?
In the Woolworths case, and the yes.
Right. Okay, I say no. I say when it comes to putting people in jail, when it comes to rights, rights are no respecters of commerce versus personality. Look, if you rape someone in the business world, you're a rapist, and if you rape someone at home and in a personal setting, it's equally evil. If you murder someone in a business context, you're a murderer, and you're equally a murderer if you murder someone in your house. So from a point of view of ethics, I see no distinction between commerce and personal rights. And if you're going to put people in jail for discriminating in the business world, well, then you should, if you're going to be logically consistent, put them in jail for discriminating in the personal life. And if you're not going to put them in jail for legal sanctions against them personally, like in the heterosexual, homosexual case, well, then you shouldn't do it either in the business world.
Well, my argument, my response to
the question?
No, because my response would be, why is it necessary to file papers when you start a business in this country as opposed to when you make a sexual preference or when you have a sexual preference? I mean, we don't have to register. We're not engaged in commerce as when we are heterosexual. We are not. We are not using public resources in any way when we're engaged. I mean, there's fundamentally a difference between who I choose to sleep with, unless I was a brothel, in which case, then I am engaging in commerce. But the idea that there's no difference between commerce and choosing who I associate with in my personal life is—I'm afraid—I just don't even know how to respond to that. And there's no difference between anything.
Well, I think there are differences between lots of things, but I don't think there's any legal difference here. First of all, I don't think you should have to file any papers in the laissez-faire society. You wouldn't have to file papers to open up a business. And let's forget about the fact that Woolworths was a corporation. Let's suppose it was just a mom-and-pop shop, not a corporation, because that gets us off the point. The point is, ethics is ethics is ethics. And if something is heinous and wrong in one context, then it's heinous and wrong in another context. And just because I'm conflating these two, namely saying that there's not a dime's worth of difference between them, namely between the personal and the commercial, doesn't mean that I don't draw other distinctions. I draw plenty of distinctions, but I don't draw this distinction with regard to the law. Now, I think it's equally despicable, or very despicable, what the Clippers guy did, and I think it's despicable what the Woolworths did, but that's not the question I'm addressing. I'm addressing the question of, should they be put in jail? And here's where you're missing my point. We all agree the Clippers guy should not be put in jail for his thought crime or for his sentiments, but according to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, anyone doing that, look, if I put up a sign on my store saying no Jews or dogs or blacks or gays allowed in my store, I'll go to jail.
Yes.
And that is a violation of the law of freedom of association, and freedom of association is what distinguishes slavery from non-slavery, so this is an improper law.
Wait a second. What is the law of freedom of association? I mean, when we're talking about, I guess you, I mean, if you don't see a difference between commerce and in your parallel universe, Woolworths did not have to file papers. or mom and pop does not have to file papers with the local Board of Health to have their restaurant. I mean, unfortunately, I mean, that's the case. Now, I suppose if we were to live in Walter Blockistan, where you don't have to file those papers and whatnot, there wouldn't be a distinction between commercial activity and personal relations, but we do. And I don't know anywhere, whether it's Singapore or Hong Kong, where you don't have to do those things. So where is this place that exists? Does it exist anywhere in the world?
Sam, let me get off the point a little. I won't answer your question for a second, but I will. If you ever want me on your show again, you're going to have to treat me more fairly. Otherwise, I won't come on your show. And I enjoy you. I enjoy talking to you. So I would advise you, if you want me to be on your show again, to, you know, let me speak and not interrupt me. Okay, now back to your question. I love that Walter Blockistan. That was really a fine point on your part. I think you're switching the subject. If you want to talk about the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, and you want to talk about the need to control business because of food and drugs or whatever, that's a whole topic, and we should probably talk about that some other time if you ever invite me on your show and if ever I agree to be on your show again. But let's suppose that it's a mom-and-pop store and you don't have to file any papers. And, you know, in Cuba, what's going on in Cuba right now is that people now, for the first time, are able to invite guests to their home and feed them dinner and charge them for it. I'm not sure if you're aware, but that's the fact. They're opening up commerce a little bit. Okay, so here's some guy. Previously, it was just, Jose's house, or Jose and Maria's house, and now Jose and Maria open up their house and they say, hey, come on in, we'll serve you dinner and we'll charge you for it. And they have a little sign that no Jews allowed, let's say. Now, in my Blockistan, I would say they should not go to jail for that. It's not nice. I'm Jewish. You're Jewish. We don't like that. We don't like it not only for Jews, but for anybody. But do they have that right? And if they don't have that right, they should be put in jail for it. And I say that there's no real difference, not a dime's worth of difference, to get back to the Alabama governor on that, between who they go to bed with and who they have in their house.
I think there are probably a lot of factors in Cuba and a lot of other ways that you can go to jail as well that we would disagree with. So I'm not sure what the point is. But in this country, it's not just the FDA. The fact of the matter is that if you're engaging in commerce, you have to do so in a way that does not deprive people of an ability to engage in commerce based upon their race. I mean, I understand on the basis on which you find that problematic, because you don't think that there's a difference between commerce and personal sexual orientation. I think to a certain extent, you know, this country has rejected that. I don't know any country that has accepted it. I don't know, frankly, in Cuba, if you could publicly say that you can discriminate based upon that. I don't know. I'm not sure that you know.
I don't know.
So maybe it is the case even in Cuba. You can't do that without going to jail. I mean, so I'm not sure what the value of that example is. But, one of the things that I've found frustrating over the years about libertarians is that they have decided on a set of principles that they want our society to work on. They would be largely rejected by people, and I don't know, you know, how it's more ethical to deny people, at the very least, commerce, the ability to engage fully in the economy. I just don't see how that's the case. But, you know, I guess that's a different set of ethics. And I don't know how that's even sort of like beneficial to the economy in any way.
Well, it seems to me that justice is justice is justice, and justice is blind, and justice should work in every nook and cranny of our society, and it shouldn't make any invidious distinctions between the personal and the commercial. And if something is right in the commercial, it should be right in the personal, and if something is right in the personal, it should be right in the commercial, and vice versa. If it's wrong in the commercial, it should be wrong in personal, and again, vice versa. I don't see how you make such a gigantic difference, and you're willing to put people in jail for something in the commercial realm, but not in the personal realm.
Do you think that we should abolish the notion? I mean, if someone's in a corporation in this country, if someone works at a corporation, and they're engaged in something like, I don't know, let's just use the case of GM, knowingly not recalling these cars, which led to the deaths of some people. Do you believe the executives of GM should be put in jail for what would otherwise be a crime of at least maybe manslaughter, negligence, knowingly allowing people to buy their vehicles that would put them in jail?
Well, there are two questions. One, if they knew of a smoking bomb? No, a ticking bomb.
Yes. Let's presume they did know, because I think that's what the evidence shows. But go ahead.
Right. Well, ticking bombs, if you know of a ticking bomb and it's in your product, yes, they should be penalized very severely.
They should go to jail as individuals.
Well, of course. The corporation can't go to jail. The corporation is sort of a legal construct. There would have to be certain individuals. If they knew of a ticking bomb, they should be dealt with severely, individually. I'm not sure which individuals, the president or whoever. But this leads to a much broader question, and that is the economics of it. And that is, you can always make the car a little safer by another $10 per part. And if you keep doing it, you get a Mercedes, which means that it's very, very safe, but nobody can afford it, and then they go on a bicycle, and then they get killed on a bicycle more quickly than on a car. So the question is, what is the optimal safety versus money trade-off? And here I think the free enterprise system is not only is the best and perhaps only way to do it. If you do it by the government, you're going to get much worse situations. I mean, if the government nationalized cars, we would have the Lada or something that they did in the Soviet Union, which just sort of fell apart. So there are really two issues. One, if you know of a ticking bomb and you don't tell anyone about it, then that's very legally problematic. But the other is, what combination of safety and money should there be? And here I think only the market can determine that.
Right. I guess maybe we've taken this as far as we can go today. Is there anything you want to you want to finish with? And also, I encourage you to actually to calculate how many minutes you got versus how many minutes I got. I think you'll find you got better than 10%.
Oh, I'm sure I got better than 10%. I was just using that as a hypothetical. No, I think overall, this is our first shot at it, and I enjoyed talking to you. I enjoyed debating people, and I think you're a very bright person, and I'd like to continue. And if we do, I'm sure we'll do better next time.
We'll try. We'll try.
Okay.
Professor Walter Block from the Joseph A. Butt College of Business at Loyola University, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on your show. Take care.
Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? my pocket.